Welcome to Living the Dream Outdoors, the official podcast of Living the Dream Outdoor Properties. We live by the motto, it's not just land, it's a lifestyle. And we live the outdoor lifestyle every day. Whether you're a landowner or dreaming of joining the ranks of those closest to the earth, we're your brothers and sisters of the outdoors. We hunt, we fish, we're stewards of the land. And our Living the Dream team will show you the way to enjoying the land and all the outdoor pursuits it has to offer. Here's your host, Bill Cooper.
Our forefathers gave us a Bill of Rights. One of those is the right to step in the front door of Pond Center, where the faint sound of eagles screeching from on high a bounding purple mountain's majesty browls the walls full of glorious firearms. It's hard not to shed a patriotic tear as your red, white, and blue blood becomes fortified by the sight of true freedom. Pond Center, located at 408 Highway 72 East in Rolla, Missouri. Or give us a call at 573-426-GUNS.
Hey everyone, this is Michael Collins with Misty Mountains Guiding Service. I'm here to talk to you a little bit about what we offer. Misty Mountains is a smallmouth and trout-specific guiding service that caters to the Northern Ozarks region. My areas include the Upper Merrimack River, the Gasconade, and a few smaller creeks in the Mid-Missouri area. Whether you enjoy casting streamers to bass, drifting a dry fly, or ripping lips with spinning gear, I've got you covered. Fishing is made easy in my state-of-the-art drift boat raft. I control the boat with ease while you or yourself and a buddy do all the work at catching fish. Besides a great day on the water, I provide all needed gear, a delicious shore lunch, and as much fishing knowledge as you can carry with you on the way home. Spots for the 2024 season are going fast. Give me a call or text today to get your trip booked. My number is 573-823-9057. Find me on Facebook and Instagram at Misty Mountains Guiding Service. It's always an adventure with Misty Mountains.
This is Dan from the White Buffalo Fly Shop, your gateway to Missouri's blue ribbon trout streams and world-class smallmouth water. Whether you're headed to Mill Creek, the Kern, or the Gasconade, we've got the flies, the gear, and the local know-how to help you fish with confidence. If you're looking to sharpen your casting skills, join one of our hands-on clinics. Or if you'd like to craft your own fly rod, build it with us in one of our rod building courses. You're always welcome in our fly tying nights to swap stories, share patterns, and get the latest hatch reports. White Buffalo Fly Shop is more than just a place to gear up. It's a hub for our local community. You'll find us at 605 North Pine Street in Rolla or online at whitebuffaloflyshop.com.
Hey, this is Justin Greel with Living Dream Outdoor Properties, and we're sitting here at the National Wild Turkey Federation Convention, and I got three pretty special guests with me. I got Chase Seals with the NWTF, Will Reckmeyer with the NWTF, and Dr. Michael Chamberlain, who probably doesn't need much of an introduction, but how are you guys all doing today?
Doing well.
Yeah, doing good.
Kind of a crazy place right now.
We were just talking about it. It's Friday afternoon here, and it feels like it's prime time, and there have been... What'd you say? They're expecting 25,000 more people than last year?
I'm hearing over 100,000 could come through here, which is insane.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Busiest one I've seen.
Yesterday it was busier on Thursday than I've seen it ever, and I've been coming to this for 20 years.
Yeah, it was.
It was wild.
We all said the same thing, and I thought maybe we were just shell-shocked from last year thinking of Saturday.
Yeah.
And the amount of people that came through, and it seemed like Thursday was better, so I thought we'd think it was like a vacation. But after talking to everybody else here, it's unbelievable the amount of turkey hunters are people that have shown up to this show.
Yeah, I agree.
But I guess we'll, kind of start off. Chase, we'll start and just work our way around. Chase, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so again, my name's Chase Hills. I'm a forester and wildlife biologist with the National Wild Turkey Federation. Got my education down at Auburn University. Grew up in the South, born and raised down there and loved it. Got the chance to jump on board NWTF, so now I am the forester for Southern Illinois. My job's split in half, so half my job is I work with private landowners through NRCS offices, assisting them with contracts and general advice. And the other side of my job is I work with the Shawnee National Forest doing stewardship work, helping manage the largest public body of land in the state of Illinois.
Awesome.
My name is Will Reckhammer. I'm a wildlife biologist for NWTF in the Missouri Ozarks. Pretty similar to Chase, where about 50% of the time I work with private landowners, and then the other 50% of the time I manage all of our projects on the Mark Twain National Forest.
Yeah, so I'm Mike Chamberlain. I'm a faculty member at the University of Georgia, and I study wild turkeys through applied field studies and have been doing that for about the last 32 years.
Wow. So, it's my idea behind this was kind of get, like you said, Mike studying it from a nationwide big picture across the board level, and then we have two guys that I work with on a regular basis that are boots on the ground in Missouri and Illinois. And, last year, so much of the conversation was about where the turkey's at, what's the number, what are the numbers doing? It seemed like there was so much of that. I'm not hearing that as much right now. And I know I've talked with these guys about it. Last year, it seemed like a lot of guys had great turkey seasons. So I don't know. I have a hard time believing everybody in the last 2 years have just figured out how to kill turkeys.
Yeah.
I would like to think there's probably a little something more to that.
Yeah.
Are you seeing the same thing?
Yeah, it really depends on where you go. I use the analogy, like the United States is a series of football fields, and in one particular state, the outcome of the game has been more positive over the last few years, and then you go to the next state or even counties within a state, and the football game is still being lost. You're still seeing populations decline. States like South Carolina, for reasons that aren't entirely clear, those populations continue to decline, but then there are some bright spots appearing. It does look like populations in states like Arkansas and Louisiana that had gotten quite low, harvest was really low. Those states have appeared to rebound now, and harvest is increasing, productivity is increasing. We're making more young turkeys than we were, and so there are bright spots. And so what that tells me is just how complex the story is for wild turkeys, because things that are seemingly going right in one place, you may go, one state over and the conditions are largely the same, but populations are not responding the same. So it just speaks to how complex it is.
Yeah, there's no one silver bullet there, right?
No, for sure, there's not.
Well, how about like in our area?
I was just thinking about that, on a very local scale, and kind of where I'm at is southern Missouri, so south of Missouri River, Ozarks. Justin and I talked about this a couple weeks ago, where I'm working and we have a group of landowners or Forest Service, a couple projects, larger acreage, and that are doing a bunch of work. Populations are great. Like in your area, Justin, there's a great population of birds. You go 5 miles, there's birds, but it's not like in that area. And so we're seeing that just responding to that larger scale projects. We're seeing that on a local scale. There's a lot of birds kind of in those areas that are getting burned and thinned and timber harvest, all that early successional management.
Yeah. Jason, how about you?
Yeah, so Southern Illinois, I would say on a whole, is doing pretty well. Probably very similar to Will. We've had several springs in a row now where we haven't been super wet, so we've had pretty good hatches in recruitment. I don't remember the exact number off the top of my head, but the DNR biologist that runs the turkey program for Illinois, I'm friends with him, and I believe last year was, 2.3 poults per hen.
And that's pretty good.
Yeah, so it was back to almost the heyday number that he has on record. So recruitment's been great in Southern Illinois. Well, that number's statewide, but it's just specifically for me, Southern Illinois. We typically see a lot, large amount of birds. I would say very much echo. I mean, it definitely is dependent on where you are. I think there in Southern Illinois, like you're saying, Will, too, you're getting guys that are doing management where we're seeing large amounts of management happening is where we're seeing the biggest concentrations of birds.
And that makes complete sense.
Yeah, and it goes back to the habitat issue with turkeys. You got to have the habitat to have them.
Well, and people doing work like what Justin, they're kind of the bird factory for that part of the county, right?
Right.
He's got all the brood habitat, so they don't stay there, but they're being hatched there.
Right.
Yeah. Helping your neighbors out.
Well, I mean, I guess I'm just a really good neighbor.
Well, that point is very important, because the fact that you can do intensive management and see localized improvements speaks to the need to talk with your neighbors, cooperate, build, try to understand that a wild turkey's range is quite large.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So if you want to positively impact local populations and not just flocks, we need to get together. We need to put information out, and we need to broaden the reach, right?
Yeah.
Throw a bigger net and try to improve management at a larger scale.
And that's something I think that a lot of folks miss, is they don't understand the range a turkey covers. On average, turkeys cover 2,000 to 5,000 acres to get there, in the Midwest and Southeast in particular, 2,000 to 5,000 acres to cover what they need throughout the year for habitat.
Right.
And so when you start putting that in perspective, then you go, oh, well, my 100 acres ain't going to do a lot. So I need to start working with others and start multiplying this. So when you start getting, 5, 10, 6, whatever landowners together, and you're actually getting management done. Now we're talking about impacting 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 acres at a time.
Right.
That's going to be a sweet spot.
Yeah. Well, and I think you and I had actually talked about it before. I think you had mentioned last year we had a great season on my farm. My son and I had a double. It was really cool. And I posted a picture of it, and one of my neighbors said something like, hey, you know, I'm happy for you guys. That's awesome, but we need to work on getting turkey numbers back up in this area. I'm not seeing turkeys like I used to. And I responded back. I said, hey, you're more than welcome to come over and look at my farm and see what we're doing to improve these numbers. And I wasn't trying to say it to be a jerk. I was trying to say, you know, he's acting like turkeys have evaporated off the face of the planet, and they haven't. Yeah. I'm just holding a few more because
I'm working hard.
I'm working on it here.
Yeah. And in the Midwest and Pacific, too, I would say that we have some folks that are still thinking of the heydays when turkeys were everywhere and it didn't matter the habitat because populations were exploding. You know, and I would say that we're definitely on the backside of that population curve at this point, trying to figure out where it's going to level out exactly. So, like you're saying, people think that turkeys should be everywhere.
Yeah, you couldn't swing a dead cat without
there's not as
one.
Many people doing management on the landscape as a whole. Therefore, we've had a lot of habitat change over time, and so turkeys are very niche where they're hanging out the most now.
Yeah.
So that's why that management aspect is so important.
Well, as an example, I get people call me all the time, hey, where should I go hunt in southern Missouri? What do you tell them, Chase? What are you going to tell them? You're going to tell them, look where they're doing a lot of timber management and prescribed burns. That's where there's going to be birds. And I'm not going to tell you where to hunt, but you need to know what good turkey habitat looks like. That's where they live.
I'm not going to brag on myself.
It's not just in all the... Like you were saying, you know, they're not everywhere.
I mean, I'm in the 1% typically in Illinois. You can get 3 tags in Illinois, and I typically get all 3 tags and tag out every year. Yep. So,
to put that in perspective, I've been hunting Illinois for 20 years, and I did it last year for the first time.
You need to hunt with him.
Apparently.
And, I need to make a trip.
I typically hunt on public ground. As a resident, I'm fortunate I get to get a Crab Orchard Refuge tag. And if you guys aren't familiar with Crab Orchard Wildlife Refuge in Illinois, they do a lot of prescribed burning. They are limited on funds being a federal agency, so there's not so much TSI and stuff. They try to do as much as they can through burning, and that's helped tremendously. Phenomenal turkey hunting. Been fortunate there and do really well in that place. But I also typically get a county tag for Forest Service ground, and I hunt on it every year. And so far I haven't been skunked yet. Even last year we had a disabled veteran hunt, first time ever in Illinois on the Shawnee National Forest. Mm-hmm. We had 4 hunters out, and we went 3 for 4 on the week's hunt. First season in Illinois. One guy killed one adjacent close to where we did some work, but not technically on it. But I took 2 guys out, opening morning, guy missed right next to a project site. Really sit on the boundary, in the pine boundary next to the hardwoods we managed. Bird was standing in the hardwoods, and he missed at 30 yards.
You're kidding me. A turkey was hanging out on edge?
Yeah. And then the next day we went into a different holler, and about 9:30 in the morning I called 2 2-year-olds out of my project site that we had just completed like maybe a year prior, straight up onto the ridge that we were standing on, and shot. They doubled up, both veterans doubled up at 20 yards. Nice. So,
that's a really cool really cool thing you guys do down there.
Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah, we're excited. Round 2 is getting to happen this year, so.
That's great.
Looking forward to it.
So, you were talking about like the different areas with the decline. You know, some places are doing better. Others are. Is there any correlation with that with like introduction rates, or is it just kind of a shotgun approach? There's really no rhyme or reason with what you're talking about.
Well, I mean, we've seen without question the declines are more widespread across the South than other regions. Part of that is because restoration was completed first in the South, and those populations kind of exploded and then asymptoted, leveled off, and they started to decline as we knew they would, but we just didn't know, to Chase's point, we didn't know what the backside of that curve was going to look like, and it got a little lower in many places than we wanted. And meanwhile, now we've seen declines in the Midwest and other areas. What's interesting, though, is the Western populations, as you go west, you start getting into Rios and Merriams, and those subspecies function a little differently than the Eastern subspecies. The Eastern subspecies, being a forest bird, they are dependent on a finite resource, the land, right? And not to say that Rios and Merriams aren't, but when you start getting out there, you get real boom and bust population cycles. And we don't, you get a lot of precipitation in the winter, and in South Texas, and you'll get literally turkeys popping up out of the ground, it seems like. You know, productivity is really high.
Right.
And those that will sustain bad years. Well, in the eastern range, the eastern is designed to have productivity that's consistent, fairly consistent, right?
Yeah.
And so if we need to be producing, you know, 2 to 3 poults per hen, and we go 3, 4, 5 years where we're down around 1 poult per hen, then you're in trouble.
Yeah.
And it takes time to recover from that. And so that's kind of what you're seeing in some of these states where things are rebounding. It can't rebound in a year, right?
Right.
It's not like a Marion's or a Rio population where, man, you catch a really low snow winter and you get spring green up that's lush and lots of rain and, man, you know, you'll see nest success. It's 40-50% in a population, and there's young turkeys everywhere, and we don't see that in the eastern United States.
So. I mean the land itself. Like, you know, go out west, it's more open, more vastly open areas. I feel like when I've gone out there and hunted them, you know, they use their eyes a lot more and they cover a lot more ground versus in eastern. There's times that I feel like that gobbler doesn't leave that same woodlot for a while.
Yeah, because their mating system, if you look at turkeys, their mating system changes as you go from one subspecies to the next. So the eastern subspecies is designed to gobble and display in small groups, in small breeding groups, and they keep tabs with each other through gobbling, through vocalizations. They don't necessarily see each other. And as you start going into Rio and Merriam's country, their ecology is, I live in a more open area. Their gobbles are not as pronounced. They don't carry as far. They are supposed to see each other. And so breeding groups get bigger, and their flock dynamics are different than what we deal with here in the South. And so that's just, yeah, that's naturally part of their mating system.
Oh, I never realized that. That's an interesting, you know, I'd heard that before about Texas as far as they're heavily rated, but it's also quail and a lot of the bird species in the South there, right?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, you... Precipitation is a driver. It is a huge driver as you get in the lower part of the Midwest, you know, the southern plains, if you will. If you catch a good winter with lots of rain, spring green up is really pronounced and everything is lush. There's tons of nesting cover. You get lots of brooding cover.
Bugs.
And you basically spread, insects, you spread nesting effort out across the landscape. Everybody's time, they all hatch at the same time. You flip the script on that, and you get 2 or 3 drought, really severe drought years. Some hens, research has shown, don't even nest.
Yeah.
And the ones that do are largely all going to fail. And so it's almost like Rio's bide their time, right? And they just wait for a good year. And when they get that good year, productivity explodes. But you don't see that in the east and the south.
Yeah.
That's interesting because in our area, when I say our Chase and Will, where we're at, usually moisture precipitation is considered, we talk about it in a negative aspect.
Right.
You know, we had a wet spring, we had bad winter, stuff like that.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It's interesting, like you're saying, it just shows that the scale of the problem, what's great in one area is bad in the other, right?
Yeah.
As the old adage is, April showers bring May flowers bring June bugs.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If you get that right there, you got the perfect storm, and that's going to be a phenomenal reproduction year.
Yeah.
But when you get that rain in May or get that rain into June, now we're negatively impacted.
Yeah, you're literally, if you look at the eastern subspecies, the timing of a single rain event can be dramatically impactful at a statewide level.
And especially in our areas, because a lot of our nesting is going to occur in our lower areas.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you typically get more of that structure that we like to find.
Yep.
Riparian areas in particular. So you find a lot of that. So when you get when it's negative, because when we get those rain events, we usually get large rain events that lead to flooding.
Yep.
And then boom, we're flooding out those nests.
Yep. And we literally, you know, we'll see in our research data on our study sites that we have GPS marked birds. We'll literally, you know, you get a front that comes across the state, and it dumps heavy, heavy rain, let's say the last week of April, which is a lot of incubations occurring, but not many nests have hatched, versus May the 10th, you get that same rain event. It has almost zero impact on April 30th because hens are incubating and they largely are resilient to that rain, versus a 3-day-old poult that's on the ground. They're dead if they get a couple of days of persistent rain with cool nighttime temperatures. So literally the difference of a couple of weeks in a single rain event can have statewide implications for productivity, and you do not see that as you go out west.
Yeah.
Sometimes when I talk to you guys, I think it's a miracle that there is, even is a wild turkey on the landscape.
They're resilient, man.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
They're resilient.
Yeah, it's insane. You know, think about, you know, pre-settlement days, and there's tens of millions of them on the landscape, and at one point we dang near eradicated them.
Yeah. Yep. And guys wearing denim bit are in denim.
Yeah, without any of the fancy stuff we have nowadays.
Part of that resiliency is why there's 100,000 people walking around this room.
You're exactly right. Yeah.
The adaptability of this bird and their ability to tolerate us as society and all the things that we challenge them with, whether it's habitat loss or a lack of management, yep. All of that. The fact that they're so resilient is why there's so many people walking around here.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've been joking around talking about this. You know, was it 1973 when NWTF was formed?
Yeah.
And it was probably like six guys in a garage or a tavern or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, could you even imagine them showing them this today?
No. I mean, I've been coming to this convention for two decades. And if you had told me back around 2005 that I would see what I'm seeing here, I'd have told you you were insane.
I came to my first one, I believe it was 2018, when I was still in school, 2017. And at that time, I was working. I had established a student chapter at Auburn University, and I was part of the run of this chapter. Came to my first convention, and I think it was like 50-something thousand was the attendance that year. And then here we are today, and we're going to probably break 100,000 this weekend.
Yeah.
So it's doubled in size in not even 10 years,
yeah,
which is crazy.
Yeah.
What was the first one you came to, Will?
2020.
No.
Yeah.
Did they have one in 2020?
Yeah. Right before COVID.
So COVID, interestingly enough, a lot of people were sick.
Yeah.
You remember that year?
Oh, yeah.
So a lot of people were sick at this convention
right.
in 2020.
Yeah.
And COVID basically blew up right after. I was one of them.
I think it was two months later when it went out.
No, the world shut down.
The world shut down.
It was March the 9th is when.
Yep.
Because the reason I'll never forget that date is I was trying to get home from Bozeman, Montana.
Oh my
from
God.
Doing a meat eater podcast. It was what launched my social media career, if
really?
You will.
Right.
I was doing that podcast, and I was trying desperately to get home from Bozeman, and I got stuck in Denver because flights were starting to be canceled because the president had announced that there was a positive case in the United States. And so everything was getting shut down, and I was sick at the time, and it was funny. I got sick here, and I stayed sick for 3 weeks after that. And I'll never forget going to that podcast and Steve Ranella, when you would do like a group hug, you know, like put your arms around each other and take a picture at the end. He was like, I wonder if we should be doing this. And I've told him since then, I was sick as a dog. But I was so excited to be on that podcast and to get that opportunity that I was pumped up on prednisone and painkillers and everything else. And I was guzzling water and I'll never forget that, and that was the 2020 convention, and there was so much chaos. Look what changed like after that.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, it's crazy.
It's I remember that time, but we don't need to relive that time because
no.
it wasn't fun for a lot of people, no. But it was. I remember like the attitudes of it, of how quickly it changed. At that point in time, I was doing something different. We were at work, and you know, I think it was like first positive case came up, and I was like, man, if this. Coronavirus, you don't have to get Lyme disease. You can't have corona without Lyme. And by Friday, we were like, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
This is crazy.
Yeah.
But I think just get back on kind of that track of it. I think the first one I came to was in 2013. Mm. And it was nothing. I mean, it was in the same building. I feel like it was the same size, but like you could pretty freely walk from one spot to another. We've had it today where we talked to the same people for 20 minutes. Because they couldn't move.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, I mean, it, I don't know. I look at all of this industry that's centered around this bird. And I think to myself, can this bird sustain itself in the face of this? I think about it. And then I think about the fact that there is this industry speaks volumes about this bird. And how impactful the bird is to our society and who we are. And I'm incredibly prideful to be able to study the bird and hunt the bird. And I see all of this and I think we have to sustain this. Like we have to get the answers to the questions we're asking, and we have to work as a community to sustain this bird and the landscapes they inhabit, because the bird deserves it. I mean, look at this. Yeah. Is all because of the wild turkey.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Absolutely.
And it's, they go hand in hand. I mean, if nobody cared about the bird, then it probably wouldn't be extinct to be gone. Right. It shows that how impactful it is and what it means to people.
Sure.
And I mean, we've been seeing families and little kids, and it's a big culture part of it, which is funny because, once again, like where I grew up in Illinois, I don't know if I knew three guys that had turkey hunting. Mm-hmm. Growing up as a kid, I was watching on those days. You two are too young to remember this on TNN.
Oh, I did.
And stuff like that. And these videos, I'm watching guys turkey hunt, and I was like, man, that seems cool. But yeah. I didn't.
Right.
I was probably in my late teens the first time I ever even saw one driving down the road.
Yeah. My wife made a comment last night, and as we were leaving dinner, which I thought was pretty funny. She can't tolerate this. Like she gets anxiety.
Right.
So she goes back to the room and she said, she's like, I saw children this morning that were so excited, young kids that were so excited to get in here so that they could see all of this display that is centered around the wild turkey. And she goes, I find it really almost impossible to believe that those kids would be excited if you were at a deer convention. And I was like, I don't know, but I will tell you, you see kids here that are just gleeful.
Yeah.
They're just tickled to death, and it's because of the spectacle that's at this convention.
Well, it's to tie right into that, a good friend of mine, this spring we're taking our kids. My son's in eighth grade, other guy's son's in eighth grade, and his daughter's and another guy's daughter's in eighth grade. We're all taking the kids to South Dakota, and we're going turkey hunting.
Oh, nice.
Oh, it's going to be, yes. Yeah,
I go
so
every
excited.
Year. I love that state.
I can't wait. Oh, this will be the kids' first out-of-state trip, and it's going to be so cool. But the one girl, she decided she didn't want to. Well, she's not going on the trip. And I was like, man, that's why wouldn't she want to go? And she goes, well, if she misses so many days of school, she's got to take her finals. That's just kind of the way it works out. I'm like, well, how many days did she miss? She's like, no, she said she'd rather go to the convention and come
then go
here
turkey hunt,
and then go turkey hunt, which seems a little counter to, but it shows you like it is a big social event. And I mean, it's cool that you see. I'm sure you guys see people here that you haven't seen. Well, I mean, I ran into Colby Sharp today. I haven't seen him in years.
Yeah, yeah. I catch up with buddies every year when I come here. I only see them here.
I think that's part of the draw.
I agree. I see people here that I literally only – I get to shake their hand one time a year, give them a hug, and it's here.
It's an unbelievable event, and it's I'd be curious to see the amount of money that's spent and the income that's generated here.
The amount of money I've spent already this week just for friends.
Yeah,
buying them ammo and whatever.
A piece of what's spent here, boy, you could have some land management. I'm telling you, there's a lot of money that's flowing through this room.
You know how many drip torches could be burned?
A lot of drip torches.
For sure.
Well, anybody that's listened to our podcast knows for me, it usually always comes back to fire. Yeah, that's a big thing that I like.
Yeah.
And I always say it's the cheapest and most impactful. You can pack huge areas with a gallon of diesel fuel.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it takes.
You know, need a little diesel and gasoline mix.
Need a little gas.
Just a little sprinkle.
A little gas.
Two thirds, one third, you'd be good.
We go a little hotter than that, Chase.
Well, I mean, you do what you want to, but if you want to play it safe, go two thirds, one third.
We'll cover your ears. I go a little hotter than that sometimes.
No, I absolutely agree, man. Prescribed burning is one of the best tools we have to manage for a multitude of species, especially turkey.
Yep.
If you're going to pick one management activity that fits in your budget, if you're financially strapped, learn to burn and be comfortable burning on your ground.
Yep.
And that will take you wonders. There's a lot of caveats to that. You need to definitely get with somebody and get educated so you know the right time of year to burn. That kind of depends on what your objectives are on the property, what needs to change. Quick run down that road. If you're trying to manipulate the structure you've got there, let's say you've got a bunch of soft hardwoods or invasive species in your on your property you're trying to get rid of, then you're obviously going to be looking to burn during the growing season. So in the Midwest in particular, you're looking really for, some people are going to hate me for saying this, but you're going to look for April through October, early October. And yes, there's a chance that you might be burning while there's potentially a nest on the ground, but you also got to look at it. If you don't have the property to hold birds, it might be better to burn it and get that habitat right and then start going, okay, now I'm going to shift and burn it back into February and March and maintain what I've got. But if you don't, again, if you don't have the habitat there in the first place, you're really not going to have much, probably not going to have an impact.
Yeah, and I know you're not going to have birds. I deal with this all the time is like landowners that are just, they're kind of hesitant to use fire. They're not comfortable with fire. And, you know, I tell everybody that that if you have an interest, just start small.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, I remember the first prescribed fire I conducted was a quarter acre. And I did a little test plot. And I was so anal retentive about my fire breaks that, hell, that fire couldn't have jumped that in a 50-mile-an-hour yep. wind, you know. But I started there, and the next thing, I felt good about it. Then I started, you know, an acre, and then I went to an old field habitat. It was yep. about 5 acres, and I burned it very carefully with a backfire, and I started becoming confident in yep. my ability, recognizing that you're always dealing with something dangerous, you know,
yeah.
that's fire.
That's...
And so as long as you, you know, if you start small and don't get overwhelmed with it,
yep.
and realize that you don't have to do all of it at one time. You know, you can scatter your burns, prioritize your burns, and be willing to think outside the box with your burning windows, like
yes.
Chase just said, and recognize that it doesn't have to occur all at, you know, in yep. February and March.
Yeah. But
that will, I think, in my experience working with clients, it makes them realize that I've pretty much got a lot of the calendar year available to me to burn.
Yeah.
I just need to pick the right conditions, not overwhelm myself, prioritize them, you know, yep. where I'm going to start and finish, and just keep plugging at it. And well, if you keep plugging at it.
Will, how many times have I text you and be like, trying to burn today?
Yeah. Well, and I was going to bring up, in Missouri, we have a phenomenal resource. Almost the entire state is covered in prescribed burn associations now.
Mm.
So
yeah.
that if you're interested in burning, joining one of those, you do a few with other people that know what they're doing,
yeah.
Or you find somebody like Justin, a neighbor that knows what they're doing, join in with them, you know. And
that's a great point. I mean, the prescribed burn associations,
yeah.
that's super cool.
And if,
yeah.
if anybody on here that's in Southern Illinois is listening, March the 28th, we're doing a Learn to Burn at Crab Orchard Refuge.
I yeah. might be there for that.
Yeah.
So I've
March
been
the 28th, Crab Orchard Refuge, Learn to Burn.
Yep, yep. So, another great one. Learn to Burn. You know?
Yeah,
yeah.
I'll be there. I'll be presenting at the beginning. And then U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will actually be conducting a burn for landowners to watch. You know, but, you know, like I tell everybody with landowners that are trying to get into burning, there's three key things to burning. First and foremost, you got to know your limitations. What are you comfortable with? Second, you got to know your weather conditions.
Yep.
And then you got to know fire behavior, which is impacted by weather conditions, but you got to be able to watch that on the landscape as you're putting fire down and know, yes, everything's good, or, oh, we better get ready to put this out.
Yeah.
You get those three things under your belt and understand how to read those and manipulate those to achieve your objectives, you will be just fine.
Yeah. It's getting comfortable with it. Like, I mean, 8 years ago, I'd never done it. Didn't
yeah.
know anybody that done it. I went to class. I believe MDC had put it on.
Yeah.
Went down there, got whatever certification that was, and like, okay, well,
prescribed burn manager.
Yep. We
yeah.
All right. Well, you know, we can try that, and then worked with you, and got a fire plan together. And the first one I went to do, like you said, I think I took a backpack blower and did a 20-yard circle around a tree stand.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
Try it. Like, what's the worst that can happen here? And that fire break was probably 3 times as wide as anyone I've ever
That's
been.
That's what I did. Yeah, 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 yeah.
There was probably more square footage of fire break than there was what I actually burned.
Right.
Yep.
I've got about 11-acre track on a buddy of mine's farm that I get to deer hunt on, and we take his kids in there turkey hunting every year. And so I first moved to Illinois, became friends with this guy, and quickly realized that we had turkeys in there. And so actually I got him. First year I took him turkey hunting, and he'd never been once in his life. Got him a bird at like 7 yards. It was phenomenal.
God.
Took him the next year. His boy guy was old enough. I think he was 6 that year.
Mm-hmm.
Took him that year. I called a whole flock in. It's early season in Illinois, so they're mm-hmm. still flocked up pretty good. Called the whole flock in, and his son shoots this Tom, and he's shooting a 20-gauge improved cylinder, and it was about a 30-yard shot. They knew something wasn't quite right, and we're getting ready to leave, and you know, just got lucky. And thankfully, he got the bird. And so I jumped up, and I run down there to grab it because I knew he was going to be flopping. And I grabbed that bird. As soon as I pick him up, I go, wow, that's a rope. Then I look down and I said, oh boy, y'all better be going to the taxidermist because you probably won't beat this one. 1.5 spurs on his first bird.
Oh,
but
wow.
I looked at him right then and I said, guys, we've got to maintain this. I said, the birds like this stand. We've got to improve the habitat. So I finally did take much convincing, but I got him to let me start burning it. I've burned that stand two or three times now. Burned it last year right at the end of March. Literally, I think I literally burned it 4 days before youth weekend. Mm-hmm. Opening day of youth season, we killed a bird right next to the burn.
Yeah.
I came back right at, might have been early May. Come back just doing something. I was checking trail cameras or what it was, but I came back in just to check on the place. I was absolutely astounded by how much woodland forbs had popped up just from burning in a stand that's had no TSI.
Really?
Yeah.
And that was burned at what time of year?
I burned it right at the end of March, probably about March 28th, give or take-ish, in Illinois.
Interesting.
But the amount of woodland form, the encroachment we had coming or popping up out of the seed bank on that stand was just absolutely phenomenal. I haven't done any TSI to it. It's got a little bit of sunlight coming in. You get a little bit of edge effect being it's a smaller timber stand. But just to be able to put burn on the, you know, fire on the ground and create that habitat. So now you've got high-quality bugging habitat going on right there, you know, and that we're in that sparse area where you've got timber blocks associated with ag fields and hay fields and stuff like that. So there's a decent amount of, you know, not necessarily the best nesting habitat, but there's decent nesting habitat around.
It's probably the best in the area.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's since I started burning that stand, it's every year we're in there shooting a bird with one of the kids.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because turkeys can't smell fire.
But boy, are they not on the same day.
I'll be damned if they don't. They must see the smoke because you light a drip torch up and start burning. And our research shows us that they're in those stands almost immediately.
Yeah.
Well, I had a cell camera in there.
That's a great point. So Justin did a burn this spring. And he texts me and said, hey, I got my burn done. You want to go take a look at it? And I said, okay, yeah, get out there. I don't know, what is it, 2 days later?
2 days later.
And when I get back, I text him and said, hey, man, there's strut marks all over your fire breaks. Mm-hmm. He said, what are you where? And I said, everywhere. Mm-hmm. And he said, they weren't there 2 days ago when I did the burn.
Yep. I had a cell camera in there that year that the boy shot that bird, or last year when he shot it right after burning. Mm-hmm. And it was literally the day of. Like 3 hours, 4 hours post-burn, had a hen in on camera.
They had blisters on their feet.
Yeah. Out there scratching around, picking up roasted seeds and bugs.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, well, last year I lit a stand, and I was coming around the backside. It had burned through probably about a third, and I needed a head fire coming up the slope to really get a control on some of the vegetation because it had been 3 years since we burned that stand, and it was starting to get pretty rank. And so I was kind of hustling, you know, to get around.
Yeah.
And the fire break was one of these convoluted things that, you know, 5 miles long.
A lot of twists and turns.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll never forget, I come around the corner and come up the hill, and there is a group of birds standing in the hardwoods. And it's almost like they were watching the smoke from the other side of the stand.
Yeah.
I spook them, of course, and they trot off. I don't have cameras there, but we finished the burn. I come back on an ATV literally 30, 40 minutes after, and they're walking across the fire break into the stands.
Yeah.
Stumps are still smoldering because ecologically they know there's desiccated insects or seeds. There's all kinds of food resources just sitting there.
Yeah.
The only negative effect to doing those fires is when you're in there during turkey season and you see that black stump and you freeze up and you think it's a gobbler standing there.
Yeah, or you get out and you've got burn marks all over your clothes.
That's just part of the process.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Well, you took me to a place. You had a workshop on a place, and it was really interesting to see. You were like, Chase was talking about times of fire and stuff like that. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, so the workshop Justin's talking about, it's a property that we have access to, and he's got, you know, basically areas of no management, no timber management, areas he's working on kind of in the process, and then areas that have been thinned and burned. Burn 3 or 4 or 5 times after this spring. And, honestly, all those burns have been dormant season, you know. He's doing his thinning slowly. He's slowly opening the canopy. He's not just – and this is hardwoods, up on the oak system. But slowly opening the canopy instead of punching big holes and letting all the sprouts and stuff. And it's phenomenal. I mean, it's one of those places you got to see it to believe it, you know.
It was so cool to go there. And the way you laid it – or the way – the property's laid out, but the way you guys presented it was we were in this section that, you know, maybe, I don't know, 10 acres.
Yeah.
This has had one burn on it, not anything else, no timber.
No harvest,
no nothing like that. And there was a little bit of stuff coming up, but not really a whole lot. And then we go to the next one. And, well, I'll let you expand on it.
The first one's no management, had a burn, but it's your typical, you know, just leaf litter, a few woody shrubs, blueberry stuff. Next one, you know, it was fire break between the two, and it's been just cedar removed out of it and burned four times, I think, maybe now. But pretty good, under, you know, herbaceous understory, 70, 80 basal area, you know.
Yeah.
And then you cross the power line and all cedar, and then also hardwood mid-story mainly has been somewhere between 50 and 70 basal area. Been burned five times now. We burned it in the spring. And it's just a perfect example for someone like Justin that's wanting to do the work on his property or anybody else to see. This is what I'm starting with. That first stand, no management. It's got to burn. But so I can pretty much show you that just burning in a hardwood system isn't going to get you turkey habitat. It's better than nothing, but
correct,
it's not much better than anything. And then the final product is a little bit of a motivation, you know, like you can get to this, but it's going to take you 12 to 15 years. I mean, that's the process.
Yeah. It's definitely not a throw and grow type, but you know, it's going to happen in 1 year. And what was really cool was while we were all sitting there talking in that last stand, and you know, you're pointing out all the different plants and all this other stuff there. We've probably been there for 15, 20 minutes, and like three deer jumped up like 20 yards from us. They've been laying there the whole time, but they just felt safe.
Yeah.
And then they ran about 30 yards and, you know, we're looking around, but once again, they never left because they still felt safe. And it just kind of shows you, like, you need the cover. They're there because they feel comfortable. It was really, to me, it was a really neat point that obviously you couldn't set that up. If you did, let me know, because I want to learn how to do that trick on land sales.
Every year when we have that workshop, I cross my fingers. I'm like, turkey brood, you know, like, walk across the power line, but we never get that, but we get the deer. So they're a pretty good example when we you know, dump a fawn or something that's 20 yards away. We're really talking about turkey management, but this management also is very beneficial to deer during the growing season as well.
100%. And Will made a critical point there too. Prescribed fire is good, but it's better and it's best when combined with reductions in canopy cover to where you could expect to get a good understory response, because if you've got closed canopy conditions, all you're doing is consuming fuel.
Yep.
You're not stimulating vegetation. As you start opening the canopy and getting sunlight on the ground, that's when fire is going to maximize its effectiveness, its benefit.
Yep.
Because you're actually stimulating vegetation, not just consuming fuel.
Well, and once again, back to a point that we said earlier, was there's not one silver bullet. Just burning is not good. It'll help. But it's not the one thing.
If you can only afford one thing, then that's your best tool to do and manage. Like, and then that goes back to manage or using burn at the right time of year to meet the objectives for the property.
Exactly.
But ideally, you're going to go in there, and you know, in the Midwest in particular, we're dealing with a lot of invasive species. You're going to go in with a herbicide application to eradicate your invasive species. You're going to follow that up with timber stand improvement or forest stand improvement. You'll hear it interchangeably used. TSI, FSI is the acronym, so you'll hear a lot of us say. But you'll follow up with that, and that's going to get us reduction in mid-story, which in our Midwest area is predominantly comprised of maple and elm, and some areas beech as well. Those are our three primary undesirable species. So you're going to reduction in those being shade-tolerant species with big leaves, typically. They put off a lot of shade, therefore we don't really have much on the forest floor. You usually get kind of that park structure where it's just wide open. Mm-hmm. So you do TSI or FSI, remove that out of your mid-story, and in most of your oak systems, you have somewhat of a broken canopy already. And so now you're getting that sunlight down. You're going to start seeing these pockets of good herbaceous vegetation popping up. Then you combine fire on that, which is going to help revitalize the forest floor. So you're going to see a really good flush of a lot of woodland forbs, which are high-quality browse for everything, especially turkeys, and great brood-rearing habitat. Especially in the Midwest, when you're dealing with predominantly wooded areas,
right?
Having that component in a timber ecosystem is essential for brood success.
Well, like you're saying too, you also have to get out a lot of those invasive species, because people think, I'll just run a fire through there and kill off my bush honeysuckle, Russian olive, you know, those type of, and
not have.
Which going back to knowing fire conditions, you know, you get a growing season burn when you're burning on basically a red flag day, you'll actually get a fire through a lot of those thick invasive spots. But you got to burn on risky conditions.
Right.
Now, granted, the fuel loads are still holding a lot of moisture. It's not going to be a crazy fire. It's going to do what it needs to do. But that makes a lot of people go, ooh, this is a red flag day. We're not supposed to be burning, and you're saying I should burn? You're not comfortable, don't do it. So then you got to fall to a different management technique. So invasive species control or TSI to get the objectives on the property accomplished.
Yeah, there are multiple ways to skin that cat.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, if you're going to tell me to wave the magic stick and fix it, then I'm going to do a combination of everything.
Yeah.
So
give them everything they need. Give them everything they need. Well, you were talking about, like, also the time of bird, and I think you kind of alluded to, but we didn't really touch on it, like you say, in burning between April and the growing season.
Yeah, so, you know, if you're trying to manipulate the vegetative structure, in particular the timber species on site and bush species, so we're, like I mentioned a lot now, invasive species, burning during that growing season window, those trees and bushes are actively alive. They're pushing resources from their roots up to put out canopies. And as soon as they put out a canopy, they're taking all the resources they're collecting by having a canopy down back into their root system to function. Right. All right, so it's actually alive. You've got resources moving up and down through the cambium layer. All right, so when you do a burn, especially a backing burn, which is a low-intensity, long residence time burn, and if anybody doesn't know what residence time, it just means that that fire sits at the base of that bush that we're trying to get rid of for a long time. With a backing fire like that, it allows it to cook that cambium layer. And so when you cook that cambium layer, you're essentially top killing those species off. Now, granted, when we're talking about tree species, diameter is going to play into that. It may take multiple fires to really get an effect. But when we're talking about small diameter, say 2-3 inches and under, you're going to get a pretty good effect on one fire. But you're cooking that cambium layer, you're top killing those species off, which is removing that shade on the environment, so we're getting that more sunlight down. So again, the April through early October window, which is typically when everything's still alive,
right,
or actively growing, you're able to put a fire in landscape at that time, you can significantly mitigate those impacts by top killing those species off. Now, again, I'm saying top killing. You're not getting rid of them for good. No. There's going to be follow-up treatment, whether that's a herbicide application, post-treatment next growing season, or in some situations, you pick up enough leaf litter, you can run another fire the next season, which is ideal.
Right.
And I will say in Southern Illinois, and I think Will could probably say the same in Southeast Missouri, and you can get multiple fires back to back. It can happen.
I burnt the same track 3 times this year.
that's an exception. Well, that's an outlier.
Now, when I say that, I tried doing so. Will and I have been trying to work on, trying to implement different times of fire and stuff like that. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna try and burn. I think it was September,
October. Yeah, early October.
It was early October. I'm like, I'm gonna try and burn it, and it burnt the edge up pretty decent. But once it got in where it was a little bit more, it trickled out. And then I tried doing it again. It didn't work at all.
Yeah.
Right.
And then the last time I got it, we took care of it. But it was a month ago.
Yeah.
Mid-January. Sorry, I don't know when this podcast is gonna come out. Yeah. it was. What I'm kind of hoping to achieve with that is I'm wondering if I'll get like a cool edge and then the center will be more of a grasses component, which isn't the best, but it's better than nothing.
Yeah, you should expect some type of change in plant diversity because of that, yeah.
And the property you were talking about, Will, before, where it showed the different, where we went through different things, you and I have had conversations about that because that was all
between November and February.
Right, but some of them were late, like we kind of talked maybe some were later, or maybe that grass had started and then it got burnt, and then so that sent them back to where the forbs could take off.
Yeah, and I mean, so where we're at, and it's a little different from Chase, is woodland habitat. We have don't have savanna. We have no soil. I mean, it's rock in the Ozarks. Right. So grasses in the woodlands are fairly minimal. Savanna differences between woodland and savanna. We're forb heavy, legume heavy, herbaceous communities, and so we're seeing that diverse forb layer, but it's taken multiple burns. We're not just, you don't just cut it and then burn it and it's just this awesome, as Justin can say on his property, we're still working on that part of it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's not fertile ground. It doesn't just.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it cracks me up where my farm's out there in Missouri. Oh, you have folks that are from Missouri come out. They're like, man, you got pretty decent dirt here. I'm from Illinois. This is garbage.
Yeah.
the only thing is.
I don't talk about Illinois too good now.
Well, we could go on about that, but that's a whole other subject.
Depends on where you are in the state.
It's all perspective. It's very sandy.
Yeah.
Remind that there's no topsoil.
Yeah.
But I get other folks come out, and I guess just because it's not just constantly rocks sticking out of the ground, they're like, oh man, you actually got dirt here.
Yeah.
Not really.
Yeah.
One other thing that's kind of popped in my head to mention, as much as I've talked about burning here and burning during the growing season, if you are working in an NRCS contract, federal cost share, unfortunately, they don't allow burn during the growing season. So that's one thing to remember, if you're looking to go through a cost share avenue. So, because their approved burn windows are typically October, depending on if you have bats around. Sometimes they shift it back to November. October to November start date through December, and then January through March.
Right.
And you're in a contract. You can still get good benefits out of burning deer in a contract.
Sure.
But if your mindset is I want to use a growing season burn to really manipulate the habitat, you're not going to be able to compensate that under a cost share contract.
When people are in those contracts, they'll be working with.
Yeah, I mean, they'll work directly with me if you're in Southern Illinois.
Can you burn during this time? And I always, and we'll probably get sick of it, but I always message, like, hey, I'm thinking about doing this right now. And, you know, there's been times where he's like, no, probably not again.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that was something I was going to bring up, talking about growing season in these upland hardwoods. Is like, to get a burn in, you almost have to be red flag. I mean, and I can't tell you to go do that. That's going to be a decision you make on your own. But it's, you know, mid-April where we're at, it's too green and it's way too wet. You're not burning.
Not happening.
So you're really looking at September, October, early November sometimes, you know. We still haven't had leaf drop in November. So you're still growing season is, or you know, but you have to, it's got to be really dry to get it to go.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah,
and its success looks in the Midwest Pacific. That time.
I thought there were days that I'm like, oh, yeah, this will burn no problem. And it didn't. There was just too much moisture.
And success looks different than a dormant season. If we get 75-80% of the unit to burn during the
I was going to say, cool thing about a growing season burn is you're going to get a mosaic.
Yeah.
You're not going to get 100% coverage.
And you got to change that in your mind.
To be honest, you know, me as a practitioner, I'm not looking for 100% coverage on a burn every time I burn it.
Right.
I don't, you know, I don't want to see black dirt across it all the way. Yeah. Little patch over here, patch over here. That's great.
Yeah. I think another thing that we get complacent about is when we re-enter stands, we tend to, like, burn on our schedule rather than the schedule that's necessary to achieve our objectives. I'm guilty of it. You know, I get busy during turkey season, then I get busy during the early fall, and I want a deer hunt, and I want to do this. And I have a calendar of my life, and sometimes I have to stop myself and say, okay, a September fire, for instance, would really help my sweet gum encroachment in this stand right here. Yeah. And I need to do a backing fire to Chase's point. I need to take my time. This is going to take all day to get this done.
Slow and steady.
I just need to stop and not worry about bow hunting, right?
Yeah.
And I need to worry about getting a handle on this stand. And I think sometimes we get complacent and we just want to re-enter stands on the same schedule every time. And I try to encourage people to get out of that mold and be willing to burn at different, you know, when it's a time to return, consider altering the timing of that fire if you can through time. And what you'll see is you'll maximize plant diversity doing that.
That's what I was about to say. You're going to get a lot of different responses.
Well, once again, there's no such thing as a day you can't burn. Are you, you know, you can't.
There's days you can't burn.
Oh, come on now. Come on. You just got to let the fire department know.
But, you know, like you said, Dr. Chairman, that brings up a great point is every time you do a prescription on your property, whether it's one stand or the whole property, et cetera, you do a prescription, you need to reevaluate. Because like you're saying, you don't necessarily want to burn the same time every single year, every other year, whatever your regime is that you're going to burn on.
Yep.
You want to reevaluate each time. Okay, is this property meeting or this stand meeting the objectives that I have laid out for it? Do I have the plant diversity that I want here? Am I seeing the animal responses I want here?
Yeah.
Is the forest health where I want it to be? If the answer is no to any or all, you got to change something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, on a rotation, like, you know, we all like all the landowners, like, how often should I burn? You know, they want to know, do I burn every 2 years, 3 years, five, whatever? And I hate that. You know, I always put Justin knows, it's probably frustrating. I burn every 1 to 5 years. You need to look at that stand and say, I'm not getting what I want. I need to burn it again. Or it looks great. The woody encroachment is down. I don't need to burn it.
Yeah, and some of it's just trial and error, you know. Like, I have one particular stand that I burned. Now, I would be scheduled to do a third burn now, so I'm burning it every 2 years. I started out, I had some sweet gum encroachment, and I had some Sericea lespediza around the edges because of a timber operation. I burn it. I got caught up in the calendar mentality, and I was burning an adjacent stand 2 years later, so I said, I'll tell you what, this stand's only like 7 acres. I'll just go ahead and burn it today. I did it again. And now I go in and I look, I evaluate after the fire during the summer, and I'm like, uh-oh. Now I've got a little more sweet gum encroachment than I had. I actually exacerbated my own problem. And so now I'm sitting this stand out so that I can come back and do a backing fire more towards the end of the growing season. Yeah. Then I can come back next spring. I can do some backpack spraying and really get at some of. So I created my own.
Yep.
I created my own problem
because
I was so prescriptive with my calendar.
And I'm going to ask. Obviously, these guys understand that. I'm going to dumb that down a little bit for my level by doing that. And then, did you also? You took away the fuel load, so you couldn't burn it again later, right? To where, I mean, you by burning at that time, you're getting a response you didn't want. But now you have to go in with another practice because otherwise you'd have to wait another 2 to 3 years to get it to where you want it to be.
This is Piney Woods, so I'm relying on needle cast as my fuel load.
Right.
And by shifting towards that sweet gum dominated community, understory community, I reduced my fuel load because I don't have grasses to carry it.
So just to add in here real quick, so for what folks may not understand is, you know, sweet gum being a shade-tolerant species, and all other shade-tolerant species, they produce leaves that lay basically flat on the ground. So when they drop, they're stuck flat to the dirt. Well, by doing that, they trap moisture. They don't catch air. They don't fluff up like an oak leaf does. So you have a high amount of moisture in your fuel load on the ground, which means you have to burn on a really what we call red flag day conditions in order to carry through there, because at that point it's dry enough that the fire will carry.
Those leaves are like laying a piece of cardboard or a piece of carpet down.
It's like laying a wet rug on top of it.
Then the problem becomes even more exacerbated because you don't get the control as the fire goes through those areas, and now all of a sudden the problem just gets worse and worse and worse. So in my case, what I'm thinking is, and I've done it on other properties nearby, is, okay, I'll back up now, and instead of going back to the well again in March or early April, I'll wait until September, early October. I'll back a fire through there, get as much top kill as I can, and then come. I'll be ready come green up next spring to see what I'm dealing with, and then I'll use herbicides to try to target some of those areas where I didn't get the control what I'm looking for. My point was I created the problem from being so prescriptive and saying, oh, I'll burn it again this time, just like I did 2 years ago.
And like I said earlier too, you know, there's a lot of different management activities out there. You know, the big three is burning, TSI, and invasive control. Well, if you're not going to put herbicide on the ground to control invasives, whether you're in the Southeast or in the Midwest, you're going to be in trouble.
Because
fire alone is not going to eradicate them.
No.
You might knock them back, but you're still going to have them in the landscape. There, a lot of these species, their seeds last in the soil for a while, so you're going to have to wait, let them sprout up, and hit them with a herbicide application.
Yeah.
You know, in the Midwest particularly, we deal with a lot of bush honeysuckle, autumn olive, multiflora rose. If you can get a fire through and top kill those species back and then let them resprout the following growing season, and then hit them when they're nice young sprouts, where you're only spraying a little bit, not having to spray a whole big bush. Perfect.
Yeah.
The tough part, and I know a lot of people fall into this category, are guys like me that they don't live close to their property. You were talking about, like, with your calendar, you know, I'm 3 hours away from my place. So it's, you know, all of a sudden I had a good day and it's a Tuesday. I might be able to make it, but do what you can with what you got.
I mean, there's a lot of life constraints. You brought up our calendars. You know, our calendars get in the way a lot.
Yep.
So sometimes you gotta evaluate everything and go, okay, what is my priorities? Do I really, you know, is this top priority? And if it is, you're gonna make time to get it done.
Yep.
Well, guys, I've enjoyed the heck out of this. And like I said, my goal going into this was I just want to sit back and listen to you guys talk. I probably talked a little bit more than I felt I should. But, man, I can't thank you enough for coming on the podcast today, and just really enjoyed it.
Yeah, for sure. Good joining.
Thanks for having
me. Yeah, glad to be here.
Well, this is Justin Breel along with Chase Seals, Will Rickmeyer, and Michael Chamberlain at the National Wild Turkey Federation.
Hi, I'm Steve Stoltz with Woodhaven Custom Calls, Mateo Camouflage, and Drury Outdoors. My turkey tip for the week this week is adjust to changes in the breeding cycle. So many hunters get marred into the same routine. Hunt a turkey from the roost, try and get one roosted. Well, that all helps. But sometimes you have to change your tactics depending on what the breeding cycle is. For instance, early season, the woods are wide open. Turkeys aren't quite with the hens yet. They're still established and dominant. You may want to use tactics such as using a gobbler decoy in your strategy, such as using gobbler sounds. to invite him over to maybe want to establish dominance with you instead of just hen sounds. The other thing you want to do early in the season, of course, is pay attention to how close you get to them on the roost. It's wide open, and you're going to have to adjust that distance between you and where you set up because it's wide open. Later on in the spring, they start getting henned up. You've got to adjust your hunting tactics to a henned up gobbler. They're not going to gobble as much, so you have to be better at getting them located and location sounds such as crow calling, owl hooting, and actually incorporating an aluminum call, which is what I do, aluminum friction call, to get them located, which is puts that higher pitch out there. And then you have later in the season where it gets heavier foliage and they're harder to hear and they're actually closer than you think they are because there's more foliage. There's all kinds of different tactics that you'll have to change your hunting tactics to become more successful as the season changes throughout the spring. That's my turkey tip for the week. I'm Steve Stoltz.
People love a good mustache. People also love a good firearm. The fine people down at Pond Center like both. They have the largest selections of firearms in the area, and with a friendly, knowledgeable staff of hombres to help you pick the gun that's right for you, you could end up riding into the sunset with a gun you love. Find them at pc72guns.com, on shelf, in store, online, or give them a call at 573-426-GUNS. That's Pond Center. Guns welcome. Mustache appreciated.
Captain Brian Wilson runs one of the tightest bow fishing operations in the business, Stainwater Bow Fishing operates out of Jerome, Missouri, and the beautiful Missouri Ozarks. They cover most Ozark streams and lakes. You haven't lived until you've searched Ozark waters during the night with Stainwater Bow Fishing while looking for giant gar, carp, and buffalo. Captain Wilson also runs a second boat on Taneycomo Lake. Call today to book a trip with Stainwater Bow Fishing at 573-263-8016. Again, that's 573-263-8016. Be sure and shoot straight.
The Living the Dream Outdoors podcast is brought to you by Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, The Fly Rod Journals, SmokerBuilder.com, Cowtown USA, Westover Farms, Scenic Rivers Taxidermy, Stained Water Bow Fishing, Scenic Rivers Guide Service and Tours, Huzzah Valley Resort, Devil's Backbone Outfitters, J&J Charters, Kaufman Cove, Alaska, Bean Creek Game Calls, Misty Mountain Guide Service, ASO Guides and Outfitters with Ryan Walker, The Rambling Angler, and Rich's Famous Burgers.
Land ownership is the American dream. Land is the basis of all life. Our wise use of this most precious of resources ensures the survival and growth of free institutions and our American way of life. At Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, we value the traditions and freedoms that land provides us. Every day we seek the solace of a mountain sunrise over traffic jams and smog, the calming silence of a bubbling stream over the sirens of the city, and the quiet of the countryside over the hustle and bustle of the world. We hunt, we fish, we farm. We live off the land. It's our mission to help our clients live out their dreams on the land as we do. At Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, we believe that it's not just land, it's a lifestyle. Join us 5 days a week on Living the Dream Outdoor Podcast as the Living the Dream Outdoor Dream Team explores the most desired outdoor properties in the Midwest and whisks you away to incredible hunting, fishing, and outdoor recreation opportunities. Host Bill Cooper, an inductee of the National Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame, will be joined by members of the Living the Dream Outdoors team each week as they tell tall tales, unveil tips and tactics, and rub elbows with some of the biggest names in the outdoor world. You'll also find the Living the Dream Outdoors podcast on your favorite social media platforms, including Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok.